Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What would you rather do? Rip the Band-Aid off and get the pain over with all at once? Or tug on it, slowly? It doesn't hurt as much, but it takes longer. Wall Street apparently has a pretty low pain threshold, so we are going to be dealing with a subprime fix for quite a while yet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Monday. It is the 12th of November today, and it takes a while to put together an $80 billion pot of money, even for the biggest of big Wall Street banks, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America by name. They've been trying for almost a month now to get a fund together to prop up the credit markets, to keep prices for securities that no one seems to want from going down the tubes. That, of course, would drag lots of other kinds of investment down with them. A bad thing, I think we can all agree. Today, we learn some more details about how that fund is going to work, or how it might not work, depending on who you ask. From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The so-called super fund is supposed to rescue what are called structured investment vehicles, or SIVs. They invested too much in troubled securities like mortgage-backed bonds. The super fund would agree to buy some of those assets to prevent a fire sale. Lou Crandall is chief economist at research firm Wrightson ICAP. He says the super fund won't touch anything related to subprime mortgages, or what he calls toxic waste.
So it's certainly not going to resolve the fundamental problem that the SIVs have. What it does is give them an option to fund themselves in the short run as they try to work out of the current situation.
A fix could benefit consumers. The kind of structured products the SIVs bought financed some $9 billion in consumer borrowing. But finance professor Joseph Mason with Drexel University says a bailout would only postpone the pain.
We can continue to grow this market even larger before we get that crisis. Or we can take those losses now and force that next generation of financial products to evolve.
News reports say the three banks leading the Superfund will have to convince other banks to pitch in about $60 billion. That's not the only hurdle. The banks plan to charge the SIVs for bailing them out. At as much as 1% of the assets, that could end up being a hefty price tag. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Let me take just a second here to put that super fund in a bit of context for you. A couple of analysts are saying worldwide, losses from subprimes could total $400 billion. We're already at more than $40 billion in just this country so far. And if you needed more bad news about subprimes, even if you didn't, I suppose, the president and COO of the now public private equity group Blackstone said today, and I quote, "The mortgage hole is deeper, darker, and scarier than he'd thought." His comments came as Blackstone reported a quarterly loss, partly on its real estate investments. Over in Saudi Arabia this coming weekend, the heads of the 12 OPEC member countries will hold a rare summit meeting. Oil ministers get together all the time. This meeting is for the top dogs. And it's a safe bet there will be some celebrating. Crude closed down almost $2 today, but OPEC members will earn a record $650 billion from oil exports this year. The cartel's long-term business plan is to spend $130 billion between now and 2012 to boost oil output. Before they do, though, they want some guarantees from their big customers. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains.
OPEC says it just wants to be sure there's a market for oil exports 5, 10, or 15 years from now. If the U.S. and Europe are going to encourage alternatives like solar, wind, and biofuels, OPEC worries demand will dry up and investments in extra capacity would be a waste of money.
I think it's frankly frightening
Stephen Lieb, the author of The Oil Factor, sees more sinister motives.
They're saying this is sort of a shot across the bow to the developed world that if you do try to go full steam ahead in developing alternative energies, we're not going to make it easy for you. Well, if we employ a carbon tax, OPEC's going to cut back on production. And oil prices are going to go even higher, and it's going to be a very serious situation for the whole world's economy.
Last week, the International Energy Agency forecast no drop in oil demand and even warned there'll be a supply crunch before 2015. Energy analyst Joseph Rahm at the Center for American Progress says OPEC's concerns are misplaced.
I would expect that if oil prices stay at current levels, we will begin to see a more aggressive effort to replace oil and to use it more efficiently. If I'm OPEC, the best way to avoid that is to produce more oil. And frankly, at these prices, that's hard to imagine a better investment for them.
Besides, Stephen Lieb says no U.S. politicians can give OPEC any guarantees about alternative fuels.
I mean, we don't know who's going to be running the country over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you're wondering what oil exports might be doing with all that money, look up. Airlines from Persian Gulf states have announced $82 billion in new plane purchases. That's a bonanza for Boeing and Airbus. And one purchase in particular caught the imagination by an airline you've probably never heard of. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Emirates Airlines is buying 93 planes from Boeing and Airbus. Price tag $23.4 billion. That's one of the largest jet orders ever.
Emirates is saying, we may be young, we may not be known everywhere in the world, but we will be soon.
David Field is with Airline Business, a trade magazine. The oil-rich United Arab Emirates launched Emirates Airlines in 1985 with 2 planes. Since then, the airline has grown by 20% annually and made a profit every year for 2 straight decades. With its latest purchase, it's nearly doubling its fleet. David Field.
They depend not on people filling the backs of the airplanes, but on people paying the $6,000, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 round trip fares to fly in the private bedrooms, lie flat seats, huge amounts of personal space.
The Middle East is poised to become the new hub for global air travel. Dubai, where Emirates is based, is building one of the biggest airports in the world, capable of handling 120 million passengers a year. The Emirates order is a boon for Airbus. It includes 70 A350s. Airline expert Daryl Jenkins.
Well, this is a very big deal for Airbus. Boeing has just romped all over them with the 787, which is one of the great planes ever. The 350 has been a troubled plane from the beginning, and now I guess it makes it all worthwhile to the Airbus people.
Both Boeing and Airbus are now expecting to set a sales record this year. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Record schmeckered. Investors didn't think much of the aviation news of the day. Boeing shares fell almost 2% today in a down market. It is worth a mention, by the way, that the Dow is now off 8% from its record high of a month or so ago. The conventional definition of a market correction is a 10% drop. E-Trade helped lead the way down. Shares of the online brokerage house gave up almost 60% today as rumors of bankruptcy made the rounds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It might seem a little odd to think of higher education as a commodity, but a study released today points out foreign students contribute more than $14 billion a year to the American economy. The number of international students here was up last year, back to where it was before September the 11th. And going the other way, the number of Americans studying abroad rose as well, but parents footing the bill might want to start paying attention to exchange rates. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The number of American college students studying abroad has soared, up 150% over the past decade. Alan Goodman, president of the Institute of International Education, which released the survey, says the weak dollar could make it hard for administrators to figure out future prices.
When you plan a budget for study abroad for a year or a semester, and you're planning it the year before, you are going to be hurt as the dollar continues to slide.
That slide is beginning to have an impact on student decisions. Austin College in Sherman, Texas, boasts that 70% of the last graduating class spent more than a month studying abroad. College president Oscar Page has seen a shift.
A little bit of a drop this year. I think probably the weak dollar probably is impacting it a little bit.
He thinks higher prices won't keep students from going abroad, but they may not stay as long.
Going for a shorter period of time, for a month rather than, say, a full semester.
Still, Page says students could consider the extra costs as a kind of investment. One Austin College student spent the past three summers studying in China.
And right now he's interviewing with a major firm for a position in China. The value added to his degree is very, very significant.
Of course, foreign exchange students coming to this country are economically significant. Again, Alan Goodman.
In the New York City metropolitan area, the number of international students here contribute about $1.5 billion to the local economy. That's more than the Yankees, the Mets, the Rangers, and the Knicks combined.
Overall, international students contribute more than $14 billion to the U.S. economy. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The realities of the foreign exchange markets mean somebody wins and somebody loses as currencies change relative values. The best example you can find of that right now is probably the euro-dollar conversion rate. The greenback got a bit of its own back today, but it's been trading at record lows against the euro for weeks now. That's putting some pressure on Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke not to cut interest rates anymore. It's also putting the squeeze on a guy named Jean-Claude Trichet, Mr. Bernanke's opposite number at the European Central Bank. Stephen Beard covers all things European for us. Stephen, what's the dilemma that Mr. Trichet finds himself in with the rising euro and the falling dollar?
The dilemma is that the falling dollar makes it much more difficult for him to raise euro interest rates to curb eurozone inflation, which is rising at the moment. If Trichet and his colleagues do that, if they push up euro interest rates, that'll push the euro even higher against the dollar, and that'll make life even tougher for Europe's export industry.
Is it tough already? I mean, are they having problems, European manufacturers?
They are, and it's getting more difficult, and it's difficult for not just European companies that are exporting to the US, it's a whole range of export markets that have been affected because as money has been pulled out of the dollar, it's piled into the euro. The euro has risen against a range of different currencies.
Is there a political dimension to this story? You know, the president of France was in town here in Washington last week, warned about an economic war if the Bush administration doesn't do something about the dollar and its slide in value. And those are his words, by the way, economic war. What are we looking at?
What Sarkozy was implying was that if the dollar decline continues, if American goods get cheaper and cheaper and swamp European markets, there's a danger that European governments might resort to the kinds of protectionist measures that pitched the world into the Great Depression in the 1930s. Now, interestingly, Sarkozy's remarks in front of that joint session of Congress last week were aimed not just at the U.S. Fed, but also to the European Central Bank back home. What he was saying was don't allow the euro to keep on rising, either cut euro interest rates or intervene in the markets to keep the euro down.
Well, now, let me ask you about that. I mean, Jean-Claude Trichet runs the European Central Bank. Is it his decision much the same way as it is Ben Bernanke's decision over here on what to do about interest rates?
Well, it is. It's a collegiate decision. He shares responsibility for this with five other members of the executive board of the central bank, as well as 13 central bank governors from the 13 member states. So they make the decision. He has the casting vote. This is very difficult for Trichet in particular, getting political pressure from the likes of Sarkozy. The European Central Bank is a relatively young central bank. It doesn't have the same power and authority as the Fed. In the year or two ahead, it's quite clear that Trichet is going to attract a lot more attention and he's going to come under a lot more pressure. He is, after all, unlike Mr. Bernanke, serving 13 different constituencies. He's serving 13 different countries. So it's going to be very difficult for him in a slowdown if some parts of the eurozone economy are buoyant while others are in recession. He's going to be bombarded with conflicting demands. Those countries that are in recession will want lower interest rates. Those that are buoyant will want interest rates to remain the same.
Do you suppose they chit-chat, the two of them, Bernanke and Mr. Trichet, and talk things over?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, Trichet said that he is in, quotes, an intimate relationship with Bernanke. So, yes, they talk regularly. They do confer. They compare notes on a very, very regular basis.
No such thing as antitrust, I suppose, in global macroeconomics.
No, they do have a bit of a monopoly, don't they, anyway, in their home markets.
From the Eurozone, our man in London, Stephen Beard. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
Coming up, a marketing campaign that really greased the wheels of the consumer economy.
Honestly, with a little Crisco in your frying pan, you can have supper on the table in a jiffy.
More of our series Consumed in just a minute, but first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street opened strongly, but stocks sagged during the day. The Dow Industrials lost 55 points, 0.4% to close at 12,987. The NASDAQ dropped 1.2%, 43 points to end at 2584. The S&P 500 ended the day down 1%, 14 points at 1439. The Dow Jones Sustainability World Index fell 1% today, 14 points, ended the day at 1384. Our consumed series will focus on marketing today, so let's take a look at some companies that make us want to buy, and buy some more. Advertising agencies Omnicom and Interpublic both gained 1%. In London, the media company WPP lost 4%. Procter & Gamble, which you'll hear about in just a minute, rose 0.5%. That's the Crisco story. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.2%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by CreditCards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards. On the web at CreditCards.com. You're listening to Consumed, a special multi-show collaboration from American Public Media. It's about the future of the consumer economy. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it sustainable? The product of a year's work by teams of reporters, you'll want to catch all of this provocative series. Coming all week on Marketplace, Marketplace Morning Report, Speaking of Faith, and Weekend America.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The Full Alliance to Save Energy Forum highlights different ways for consumers to lower energy bills and help the environment. Eco-friendly businesses gather in Taiwan to talk shop at the 2007 International Conference on Green Products. And in London, a corporate responsibility event looks at ways companies can go green in the workplace. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Welcome back to Consumed, our series airing all week on this and other American Public Media programs. As you might have gathered from the name, we are talking about consumption, the stuff we buy, and how that shapes American life. For most of us, shopping is second nature. It's just something we do. But it wasn't so long ago that Americans had to be taught how to consume. Our sustainability reporter Sarah Gardner brings us a slice of the story.
Get all the measuring tools you need.
My mom is about to make a pie, and in her book, that requires Crisco. Not butter, not lard, not some generic shortening. Crisco.
Because I like it, because it's all vegetable, and it's really better for your health, I think.
Mom, a marketer's dream, and a product of marketing history, too. See, Crisco maker Procter & Gamble was a pioneer in the emerging science of creating demand. Historian Susan Strasser says the Crisco experiment started in 1911 when the company was selling Ivory soap. Cottonseed oil was a key ingredient.
And they decided to develop a product that would use a lot more cottonseed oil so that they could control that market, really.
Procter & Gamble scientists came up with this white, fluffy substance. It sort of resembled lard and yet had no taste and no smell. It wasn't food exactly, but the company would ask consumers to bake and fry with it. Thus began an American mass marketing milestone.
Originally, they tried to call it Crispo, but then they discovered that a cracker factory already had the trademark.
P&G hawked its new product as a scientific discovery. The company sent free samples to every grocer in America. They held Crisco teas, an early version of the focus group. P&G even niche marketed the product as kosher to the Jewish community.
One of the rabbis, the Cincinnati rabbi, famously said that the Hebrew race had been waiting for 4,000 years for Crisco.
Marketing scholar David Stewart says P&G's genius was not only giving people a convincing reason to try the product, but training them to use it as well with free cookbooks and recipes.
First of all, they focused on the health benefits, recognizing that this was a time when we didn't know about trans fat and so forth. And then they taught people how to use it. They taught people how to cook, gave them ideas. And between giving them a real benefit and information about how to use the product, they were able to get people to adopt it.
Crisco's crowning achievement was creating demand for something nobody knew they wanted. That's the cornerstone of the consumer economy, after all.
Keep cooking with Crisco. It's all vegetable. It's digestible.
All of this really gave women a new role in society, as particularly as consumers.
Historian Gary Cross says pioneering mass marketers like Procter & Gamble won over American housewives with their persuasive pitches.
You women kind of have your hands full these days.
Well, it's the truth, isn't it, friends?
But women were eager pupils of the emerging consumer economy, too. Women may have lacked political power in those early days, but the new consumerism gave them economic influence like never before, particularly during World War II.
There's so much volunteer work to do for the war, even the children are helping out. Honestly, with a little Crisco in your frying pan, you can have supper on the table in a jiffy.
Funny, that's what my mom says, too. Her Crisco cherry pie has been a fixture in the family for half a century now. P&G may have created the demand for this fluffy white stuff, but ultimately it's consumers, like my mom, who decide whether products end up a flash in the pan or one of life's necessities. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
You can listen to some of those original Crisco ads and catch up with the rest of Consumed on our website. It's marketplace.org. What Sarah and her mom were just telling us about was the push side of the consumer economy. Companies manufacturing a need their customers didn't necessarily know they had. There is a little bit of the chicken and the egg here, because just as often the delicate balance of our buying habits is tipped by the pull of consumer demand. We got Kit Yarrow on the line to help us figure out why we want what we want. She's a professor of marketing at Golden State University. And when we talked, I asked her which came first, consumer desire or corporate marketing?
Well, I think they're pretty evenly matched. You know, no marketer or retailer is successful in the long term if they're not satisfying real consumer needs. But at the same time, people really aren't buying clothing, for example, to stay dry when it rains. They're buying clothing to express who they are to others. They'll feel more confident in outfits. So these needs actually are really closer to emotional needs or need to connect to other people or show people who we are.
All right, but why, though, are we now using products to communicate so much?
You know, a couple things. One, I think because people move so much, if they don't live in the same community like they did 50 years ago, and because we're so much more global, I think the idea that people need to figure out very quickly who we are in our community and who other people are, that's part of it. And then secondly, all of the technology at our disposal allows us, I think, to process information really quickly. And we've become really well trained and really proficient at making use of tidbits of information and allowing them to represent something bigger.
But it does sound, just to be objective about this for a minute, it sounds a little bit superficial. It sounds almost as if you're saying we're defining ourselves by the stuff we own.
Mm-hmm. We are becoming a more and more superficial society. So, and I'm not saying that just in a negative way. I think people always have had the need to connect to each other and to show other people who they are and to be understood by other people. It's just that today, in our fast-paced, disconnected society, we do that through the products that we have in very quick visual ways. And what marketers have to do is to truly understand their consumers' deeper, more emotional needs, and you can be sure that they're researching that.
Well, so make me hip, as it were, and tell me what the marketers are doing.
Well, you are definitely already hip, but I'll throw you a few of the things that retailers and marketers are doing. So, you know, one thing is to try to limit the amount of supply out there, their perception of the amount of supply, or to limit the amount of time somebody has to make a decision. And when consumers are in that situation, there's a little bit of fear of losing out, and consumers get a little wiggy. And, you know, the use of celebrities and the association with movements, that's another hugely emotionally appealing and oftentimes irrational aspect of purchasing.
Do they work? And I'm thinking now of specifically the green movement as what might be the archetypal marketing ploy, right? I mean, if you want to save the planet, be green.
They definitely work. Consumers have a great, great need to feel like there's purpose in life and that they're connected to things that are larger than them. And so when marketers and retailers make a connection with a charity or make a connection with a movement, they give consumers two things. One, they give them a bigger sense of purpose that feels great and inspires them to buy. And two, it allows people to rationalize a purchase that they might not make were it completely rational.
Kit Yarrow is a professor of psychology and marketing, which is perfect for us, at Golden Gate University up in San Francisco. Kit, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. By the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today before we go. You remember Kit Yarrow said one man's social movement is another man's marketing opportunity? Well, sustainability is shaping up as a downright bonanza. Marketers guesstimate green and socially responsible spending every year totals more than $350 billion. The market is growing by 10% every year. Al Gore is riding sustainability to the venture capital markets. Gore announced today he's joining one of Silicon Valley's most notable VC firms. The former vice president will dip into clean tech investments with Kleiner Perkins. Gore says he's going to donate his salary to a climate crisis think tank he founded in Palo Alto. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 55 points, 0.4%, to close the day below 13,000 for the first time since August. The NASDAQ lost 43 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 14 points. That's 1% even there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Our senior producer is Celeste Wesson. Consumed continues tomorrow.
Well, I don't see how consumerism can't be contributing to global warming because we create so much trash.
Can our shopping habits stand the heat? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.